Welcome to Historically Thinking, a program devoted to all kinds of historical knowledge and to the ways that we achieve it. I'm your host, Al Zambone, of the Department of History at Augustana College. Our website is historicallythinking.org, where you can subscribe, find more information about our guests, links, and related readings. Our email address is mail@historicallythinking.org. We'd love to hear from you. Hello. In his letters, one of George Washington's favorite literary tropes was to refer to being safe again under my own vine and fig tree. He meant this reference to an Old Testament verse both literally, he had vines and fig trees aplenty at Mount Vernon, but also to his position as a Virginia patriarch. Before they were founders, the men from Virginia, Washington, Jefferson, George Mason, Patrick Henry, were fathers. And it turns out, their fatherhood was extremely important to their founderhood. That's the thesis of my guest, Lori Glover. She is the John Francis Bannon S.J. Professor of History at St. Louis University. The author of numerous books, it's her latest, The Founders as Fathers, The Private Lives and Politics of the American Revolutionaries, that is the subject of our conversation today. Lori, so thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
This is one of those books which is, I kind of wish I had written it, but it's nice that someone else did. I note with, as we are both historians of early Virginia, I note with great glee the subtitle, which I know you're not responsible for, I won't, but at Yale they decided to call it the Private Lives and Politics of the American Revolutionaries, and all of them are Virginians. I can just imagine what John Adams would have said. So what did a family mean in colonial Virginia? Because we're going to have to step back to the decades prior to the Revolution to tease out this question.
Well, you know, today we think of family in a very atomized, specific way, and with principally emotional responsibility, and maybe secondarily financial. But in early America, as you know, family had a much wider and deeper meaning. Family was intergenerational, not simply based on the household. In fact, their families structurally looked a lot like ours do today, because death in early America did what divorce does today. But in terms of the functions of family, it was much more encompassing than the way our families operate today. We send children to school, and when we get sick, we go to the hospital, and people go to university and get an education, and we borrow money from a bank. And in early America, at least among whites in the Anglo population, most of those functions were fulfilled within the family. And so they thought more deeply about family, I think, than we do, and more broadly.
And, of course, the family also contained enslaved people.
Yes, and this is very difficult, I think, for people in the 21st century to understand. Absolutely, men like Jefferson and Washington, when they wrote about their families and counted the people within their families, they would count into the hundreds, and they thought about, and they used the words, you know, our family, black and white, or my white people and my black people. They certainly did not care emotionally for slaves the same way they did as of their white relatives and the white members of their household, but they very much thought about them as a vital part of their family, although admittedly the black members of the household often sacrificed and were sacrificed for the needs and the ambitions of the white members of the household.
Yeah, do you know of anyone, and this is, I have to watch out in the course of this conversation that we don't start playing, get a little too, esoteric.
Okay.
But nonetheless, as I'm thinking this, are you aware of anybody with, like, say, a 5 to 10 enslaved people who refers to my family? I can't offhand think of any correspondence with a small slave owner.
No, I guess I can't either, although my research, both for this book and the book before that that was set in the slaveholding South, were very much centered on the elites who, again, that's sometimes difficult for people in the 21st century to appreciate the differentness of the past, but they were very much in the driver's seat in terms of politics, culture, education, and economy.
Yeah.
And they're the ones who had the wherewithal to save, you know, reams of letters and all
yes.
of their diaries, and their descendants kept them with great reverence. And so the archives are very much tilted toward, you know, the cohort that I looked at
yeah.
in particular and elite slaveholders in general. But I do think you're right that there's probably a strong class dimension to that. And, of course, African Americans would not have thought about their enslavers being part of their family.
Yeah, no. We have to be careful how we start interpreting that. For example, the WPA narratives. Yeah. So to be a family and means for these people to have a father. And what does fatherhood mean when you have a family like this?
Well, in the colonial period, it meant responsibility for the livelihood of the white members of the household, for the general stability of the estate, the financial productivity of the state. It also meant taking responsibility for middling rank and poor neighbors and serving in, you know, what we would think of as low-level government offices, serving on the local vestry, serving at county court day, maybe serving in the legislature down in the colonial legislature down in Williamsburg. So there was a political and a service dimension to fatherhood in colonial America. There was certainly an economic one. And then there was responsibility for the reputation of the family, people living within the household and under the authority of the patriarch, but also the next generation, so the protection of the family name as well. And a lot of that got challenged and upended in the course of the American Revolution.
And we'll get to that. But serving in an office, you're right, the Robert Carter III, for example, who's tremendously wealthy, we find him serving as church warden on the vestry,
yeah.
Which in England was a very minor position given to usually someone from the lower classes or very lower middling class who's just barely making it financially. And yet here's one of the wealthiest men in Virginia serving as that. Wouldn't he have been fined if he hadn't served in such a position?
I mean, I think that on the county level, that varied. I think they could have been fined. I'm not sure that people were fined. I mean, for example, George Mason, who I write about in the book, was sort of chronically absent from various service positions from time to time, and there were threats of being fined,
right.
But I'm not sure how often they were imposed because the reputational cost of not fulfilling obligations in the community were of a greater concern, I think, to men of this generation than paying minor fines.
But what's interesting, at least in terms of law, that there was a concept in which there's a concept of shaming and of fining for not fulfilling your sort of patriarchal, your family duties.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right.
What do you think? I'm thinking of an argument that David Hackett Fisher made controversially in Albion's Seed that patriarchalism. Sir Robert Filmer, who actually had family connections to Virginia, who author of Patriarcha, which then John Locke refutes in First Treatise on Government before he goes on to write Second Treatise of Government. What do you take his idea or suggestion that patriarchalism, was it actually almost a political philosophy in Virginia?
Well, you know, lots of historians have tackled the issue of the meanings of patriarchy and when patriarchy gives way to paternalism. And I guess in this book I was less interested in engaging those kinds of philosophical or intellectual debates and more interested in charting how ideas about power over families and power over communities, male power, how that got expressed in the colonial period and enacted, and then how that got transformed during the revolutionary period.
Just for listeners, I would say that was an example of an intellectual historian asking a social historian a question, and the social historian says, I don't care. That's a little pro tip right there. And not that she's wrong either. I have to confess, it's hard to figure out where exactly that chicken and egg came from. So I was thinking of other forms of mastery as I read this book. How do you think this also patriarchal, this paternalship, paternal, this fatherhood image, how does this fit to land as well?
Well, you know, wealth in colonial and early national Virginia was intricately tied to property ownership, and by that I mean both land and slaves. So mastery over land, I'm trying to think if there's an exception. I'm not thinking one off the top of my head. Almost invariably required mastery over slaves in order to make that land profitable. So I think there's a very strong racial dimension to patriarchal power as it was practiced in colonial Virginia, and that doesn't change very much in the wake of the American Revolution. So it was an agricultural society by and large. I mean, there are some people who diversified. George Washington is a great example of that. But it was a heavily agricultural-based society of where power traced through bloodlines via property ownership. Again, real estate and human property.
What, to get to the coming of the revolution, here are these patriarchs, these fathers of property, of people, of these extended families, and they are rebelling against the father of their country, of their kingdom, who is the king. Talk about that, if you would.
Well, it was a very radical and dangerous and mostly unprecedented proposition that they were engaged in. I mean, Bernard Bailyn wrote about this many years ago, that these nobodies on the far fringes of nowhere announced that they knew better than all the civilized world, and better, in fact, than the king and all of his ministers in London. And so there's an audacity and I think a danger to that. Circling back to what you said about the subtitle of the book, I did pitch the founders as Virginians because I think the radicalism, of course, emerges in Boston, and we must give Adams cousins and the people in the street of Boston, they must have their due. Sure. But I think the ideas that drove that rebellion against that drove the creation of a nation in the wake of that rebellion against the king, I think that emanated principally out of the great houses of Virginia. And I think the culture of Virginia stamped the American Republic in deep and profound ways. So I guess those are the first two things I think about. And then there was a domestic peril, I think, and I mean that peril in terms of what would happen in Virginia and what would happen in their own households when they announced that, you know, hereditary monarchy here. And here, of course, Thomas Paine voiced this most forcefully, that hereditary monarchy won't bear looking into. Mm-hmm. Well, that's really the structure of the whole colonial enterprise and of the society that they're presiding over, that you're born to a place.
Yes.
And so, you know, there was a lot of concern about how to create a system of government and create a society that could replace that without fully upending it.
Let's talk about, let's use a sort of a case, because Washington as a case is particularly interesting, especially if we take him up to that moment where he decides to be or accept appointment as commander in chief. Not that he would have denied, not that he would have turned that down. He never could have done that. But his whole you begin discussing families and so and the tangled cousinry, which to quote defined both by the randomness of death and calculations of wealth, and greatly complicated by race.
Mm-hmm.
How does Washington exemplify that tangled cousinry?
So he is a son of the second wife of a patriarch who has died and left most of the estate to the older half-brothers.
Yep.
And so the formation of his character takes place in that context, right, of being without a father, of being without a certain absolutely certain patrimony, of needing to cultivate those other half-brothers, cultivated the Fairfaxes, as well to sort of find surrogates for himself in a world that, again, trace power through family bloodlines. And then, of course, as did many up-and-coming and ambitious men in colonial Virginia, colonial South generally, he found a highly desirable, rich young widow to marry. And it was really his marriage to Martha Custis, the widow Martha Custis, that cemented a place for him in Virginia society. She had two young children from her first husband, and they never had any children. They, George and Martha Washington, never had any children of their own, but they later on informally adopted two of her grandchildren, his step-grandchildren. So his family was, the genealogy is very complicated, but not that unusual in colonial Virginia. That is, people die and other people fill the void, and families are a kind of a hodgepodge of steps and haves
The things that, as you point out so shrewdly, the things that we're used to by divorce, they're used to from death. I figured once that I think five or six people had to die before George Washington could become George Washington. It was Lawrence died, but Lawrence had a child who disappears from the record. Then I think his widow has to remarry. She remarried. So now he's got Lawrence's estate. But then, of course, I forget who else had to die. But then, of course, Mr. Custis dies.
Yeah.
And then Martha Dandridge Custis is available. People don't realize often that Thomas Jefferson also married a widow. She was, 23, but she was a widow.
Sure.
Lots of people end up marrying widows or widowers. Like Patrick Henry.
That's right.
Colonial,
that's right.
Revolutionary Virginia.
Yeah. No, I think you're right about Washington. I could go back and probably look through all my charts and figure out the exact number, but you're absolutely right that there had to be multiple people to pass away in order for him to secure the wealth and the connections and be ready to seize the opportunity. I mean,
yes,
he was ambitious and he had a great skill set, but that wasn't all it took to rise in colonial Virginia. You had to have people opening the doors for you.
Yeah, there had to be by either death or by patronage. There has to be a lot of luck, if you want to call it that. But
yes.
Otherwise, I think if I looked at, he only had Ferry Farm and about 40 or 50 acres around it. He would have been a very different guy than the one we know.
Yes.
So he is a stepfather, and he has a son that is no good, a stepson that is no good. Jackie Custis really is a hard bargain for any stepfather, I think.
Yes.
Talk about that a little bit.
Well, by the time he was old enough to know his own name, Jackie Custis knew there was a fortune awaiting him that basically meant he wouldn't have to work a day in his life. He had one sibling, a sister. She died in her late teen years. I want to say she was 16 or 17 years old. She had sort of chronic epilepsy, and she died. I want to say maybe she was 15, 16. He was a couple years older than her. In any event, he became at that point the sole heir to his biological father's estate, and he was the reputational heir to, by the time he's a young man, to the most famous man in all of America. And on top of that, In writing the book, I developed a great deal of interest in and then respect for Martha Washington that I had not, I guess I hadn't really thought about her much before. But if you think about being a young wife and you have two children and you think the future is bright and then your husband dies and then the daughter dies and you're left with just one child, and she, you know, by all accounts, she indulged him in every way she possibly could. And I think George Washington, as the stepfather, with no ability to control the inheritance, I think he felt, and he wrote about, being in some ways on the outside and having a limited ability to control Jackie Custis. So all of those things together, I think, were not helpful to his development into the kind of man that his stepfather wanted him to become. And I think that was part of why, during the war, Washington sought out young men like Lafayette and James Monroe and Jack Lawrence, who were exactly the kind of young men he wanted to leave the future to.
Yeah.
He is the opposite of what he could never make out of Jackie Custis.
And so many of them, given the conditions of the 18th century, were themselves fatherless.
Right.
Lafayette lost his father at 2. Henry Knox's father ran away when he was 11.
Yeah.
Alexander Hamilton's ditto, I think, more or less the same age.
Yes.
So these were all young men who were ready to be sons.
Right.
They were looking for a father. He was looking for sons.
Yes, I think absolutely.
There's one line you quoted. I remember this letter. It's one of those Washington's very, very clear and direct and trip hammer pro style. When he speaks to a university administrator at King's College in New York, when he says he'd hoped that Jackie would become a responsible man, but these hopes are at an end. That's pretty chilling. But Jackie basically enlists to be part of the battle at Yorktown and then dies. And as you point out, his stepfather is not particularly emotionally moved by this.
No, you know, today we have an idea that parents should love their children unconditionally.
Yeah.
And in the 18th century, that was not the dominant mindset. I mean, most people whose letters I've read and that I know very much about thought about conditional love, right? That children had to earn, once they reached a certain age and were moving toward adulthood, that they needed to earn the love of their parents. And by love, they meant, of course, affectionate approval, but also support, connections, allegiance to them. And so, you know, I think what happens during the war is Jackie Custis is failing to show up at the legislature where he's a representative, where he's selling away land, where he, I think, he has four children by the time he enlists in the war and not taking sufficient responsibility for them. If he's doing all of those things to fail and earn the ill will of his surrogate father, Washington seeks out young men worthy of his love and respect and allegiance and support. So it's very much a part of the conditionality of parental approval.
Yeah, talk a little bit more about that, because one of the really fascinating parts of this, which I never thought about, and relates to stuff I have, some of the things I have noticed but can't quite explain, was this, the ability, basically, the way that they develop character in their sons or their grandsons or their stepsons, they're both giving them, they give them plenty of rope with which to hang themselves.
Right. So,
or to climb up.
Either way. That's right. So the revolution is, you know, introduced a concept of self-determination and of individualism, that you would earn the respect of fellow citizens and the right to lead through integrity and virtue, and not through inheriting wealth and power. And so, you know, the child rearing model moved toward heavy on indulgence, or what we would see as an indulgence, because they wanted young men to choose to do the right thing for themselves and for their family. So rather than compelling that through force or even the actual act of disinheritance, there was a lot of coaching and cajoling and then leaving young men, and by young men I mean 14, 15, 16, 17, leaving them to make a lot of decisions on their own to test their judgment. And Patrick Henry told one friend that he had one son who was behaving in an appalling way, but he said, you know, even wickedness can be a great instruction. So, you know, I think there was a lot of, we would call it erratic behavior, a lot of willfulness, a lot of excess drinking, a lot of overspending of money, of gambling, of squandering away education. And adults in the early republic, elite adults, worried about that, but they didn't think it was in the best interest of their families or of the republic to intercede too far, that you couldn't control a man, a young man, into being a worthy citizen and a worthy man, worthy of the title of man. He would have to choose that for himself and enact it by his own conduct. So taking political self-determination and reading it into child rearing.
Do you see that only as a consequence of the revolution? I'm going to push you on this a little bit. Don't you think that was a way of behavior with children prior to the revolution?
I do, but I think it gets intensified because of the revolution, and it is infused with new political meaning.
Okay.
In ways that it, so it's a, maybe it's an exaggerated version of a phenomenon, because the consequences of youthful misbehavior are, in the minds of people in the early republic, are much graver now.
Okay. Yeah.
Than they were in the colonial period, because in the colonial period, you know, family could rescue someone, they could, you know, write a course. But in the early republic, if the young people don't develop the right qualities,
yes,
and don't exhibit the right leadership, then the whole republican experiment will fail.
Right. So there's enormous expectations and hopes being put upon these young men.
Enormous.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there's, you know, there's no moment really in the early republic for a young man to follow the example of the founding generation. I mean, I have in the book, it's one of my favorite quotes. I think it perfectly captures child rearing in this period. It's from St. George Tucker, who's a Virginian, and he writes to his stepsons that the world is a circle about every man, exactly of such a size as his abilities make it. And he goes on to say, you know, Mr. Booker is well known around Petersburg as a good chair maker, and Mr. Taylor is known as a good cabinet maker, but the whole world knows that Franklin is a great philosopher and that Washington is a great general. And so he says to the boys, and they're 15 and 16, I think, it's your election at present if you'll have a world like Mr. Taylor's and Mr. Booker's, or like Dr. Franklin's and General Washington's. And so, you know, in that is the expectation of self-determination, but also of impossible achievement, right? Because without the revolution, there isn't a Franklin.
Right.
There isn't a Washington. So it's the individuals, but the individuals in a particular moment.
Yes. And now the possibilities are blown. I mean, this goes right, there's a direct line between that. I mean, it's almost the same thing as saying, you know, this little boy or this little girl now could become president of the United States. It's sort of the same exact American ideal.
Yes.
Of almost impossible, in the Virginia context, in the context you're talking about, an almost impossible burden on these young people to achieve.
I mentioned near the end of the book, I talk about what happened to some of the sons of the founders long term, and I went and read many of their obituaries, and I discovered the most interesting and kind of sad phenomenon, and that was no matter how long they lived or how much they achieved, many of their obituaries were devoted almost wholly to their fathers.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's the way it, yeah. George Washington Parke Custis finally got things straight because he could give lots of anecdotes about the old man.
Yes.
You know, that was how he righted his life. Not as a successful farmer or investor or anything like that.
No, but of tending to that legacy.
Yes, yeah. John Mason seems to be the only one that really made a sort of separate life for himself. I noticed in these people. I mean, a banker and a merchant and so on.
Yeah, and very successful. But even he, when he died, there were two or three sentences about him, yeah, and then the rest of it was all about his father, who'd been dead for 50 years, I think.
Yeah, and what's the line? Never be a child of a famous person, or something.
Yeah, maybe.
Like that. Washington, get back to him a little bit. I was really struck by the way in which, of all these people, all of them had this tension between being a father or being a founder,
mm-hmm.
a father or a revolutionary. And all of them, I mean, Madison's too young to fit into this sample, but all of them, with the exception of Washington, actually, as it were, took a break, took time off from being a revolutionary and a founder. Explain that. I hadn't thought about it this way before.
So, as you said, there's this tremendous tension between taking care of family and taking care of civic obligations, which were not contradictory or problematic in the colonial period because, you might be gone for a day or two, or a week or two, but now in the Revolution, you're gone for months, and in Washington's case, years at a time. And so it's not a seamless thing to honor both your civic community obligations and your family obligations. And everyone I studied, as you pointed out, except for Washington, felt that and reacted at different times by leaving politics, leaving family, leaving politics, leaving family, back and forth and back and forth. And Washington was alone among this court. I'd have to look closer at John Adams to be able to say much about that. But among the people I looked at, Washington was alone in always choosing political service, military service, and placing that before family. And I think part of that has to do with the nature of his service. I mean, he was a military commander during the war, which was different from Jefferson being governor of Virginia or George Mason writing the Declaration of Rights in the Virginia Constitution. But I also think it was important that he didn't have any children of his own, and he had as a mate a very competent, very devoted, and very healthy woman.
Mm-hmm.
So, part of what's pulling Jefferson back and forth is the sickness of his wife, Martha.
Mm-hmm.
And part of what's pulling George Mason back and forth is his wife dies and he's basically a single father. And there was mm-hmm. a period where Patrick Henry was a single father.
Yeah.
And because the Washingtons, either because he was infertile or impotent, one or the other, they didn't have any children, and she didn't have the chronic health problems that went along with constant pregnancies, and she had a great sense of resolve, and she was very competent. She had run her husband's estate between the time he died and she married George Washington, and so I think his family circumstance enabled Washington to always choose public service over family concerns in ways that other men either couldn't or didn't.
Yeah. And all of them, I think there's also you do more than suggest, there's also for all of them the pull that they also are required to establish their families and maintain their family's reputation.
Yeah.
And that is as powerful a pull as being a revolutionary or a founder.
Absolutely. wanting to take care of their households, to take care of their property, to take care of their children, to make sure that they're leaving that part of their progeny the right kind of bequest is often in tension with the desire to leave the right kind of bequest for progeny writ large. That is, what are we going to leave to the next generation of Americans versus how are we going to take care of the children sitting around our table at dinner time?
Now, those of us who study colonial women in Virginia and other places know that they seem sometimes to have, well, we know that they have much more power.
Can you speak up a little bit?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Those of us who study colonial women in Virginia mm-hmm. and otherwhere know that they have often more power than people generally believe that they did, partly because men died quickly and they wrote really fantastic prenuptial agreements.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the things that changes with the revolution, as they also transition to the idea of Republican motherhood. And one of the things you make clear in one of your chapters is that this is certainly this is founders and fathers, not founders as mothers, or mothers as founders. What happens to young women in this system?
I did focus the book overwhelmingly on really six characters. There are the five men you mentioned, and then Virginia is the sixth character in the book. But I also, wanted to make clear that none of them would have had the careers that they had, would have led the lives they led without the women in their lives. But in terms of what happens to women in the early republic, I think many of the same assumptions about self-determination and proving your own abilities being part of a meritocracy, I think that was taught equally to boys and girls, but to very different ends, right? So Jefferson wrote his daughters about the necessity of them educating themselves, of learning how to cook and manage an estate and make good conversation and be forthright in their dealings with people, that they needed to do those things so that they could manage a household and be a good wife, mm-hmm. because that was the ultimate destiny, I guess, of a young woman in the early republic, to ably manage a household and to be a successful wife and mother, whereas those same kinds of qualities of self-determination and meritocracy were directed at young men to get a university education, to prove their ability to lead politically, to prove their financial responsibility and self-sufficiency, so that they could lead a household and lead the republic. So one had a familial outcome only, and one had a sort of familial and political outcome. But the underlying lessons, I thought, were more similar than different.
Huh. We often attribute the term founding fathers to Warren G. Harding, I think, from when he was actually a senator.
I'm sorry, Lori.
We're going in and out here.
Okay.
We often attribute the term founding fathers to Warren G. Harding, I think from when he was a senator from Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
But you make very clear that that idea of them as fathers extends much farther back, even to Washington, seen as a father of the country in his own, in it, certainly even when he's general, even before he's president. But one thing I'm curious about, in the years after the revolution, did fatherhood and families suffer a post-revolutionary crisis in Virginia?
Post-revolutionary crisis.
Yeah. Is there a diminution in the sense, a sense of a father's authority?
Well, certainly, with the challenging to monarchy and hereditary power, I think that absolutely played a role in undermining the absolute authority of household of fathers over households, and you know, the training of young men to exercise their own judgment and make their own choices and decide how to spend money and decide about their, you know, what education they would pursue. All of that undercut the authority of fathers. I guess the thing I saw that was that stood out in my mind more of reading the evidence, though, was the gradual diminishing of Virginia's influence.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in the early years of the Republic, of course, there's that Virginia dynasty over the presidency, and they're running the state house, and Marshall's setting the policies for for the Supreme Court, and Madison's in charge of the protocols in the House. And so there's a tremendous amount of sort of short-term influence in the federal government. But even as that is unfolding, I think the economy of Virginia is the Virginians are losing the financial power that they had in much of the colonial period, and they're losing the political power gradually to South Carolina, you know, in the 18-teens, 1820s, and mm-hmm. so that I guess I saw South Carolina in the antebellum period moving to the forefront of leadership in the South, and the at seizing that from Virginia, and then I think Virginia is losing economic influence to the Southwest. Mm-hmm. So the sort of slow slide of Virginia from its glorious past that lots of people at the time commented on, I sort of saw that not just in their reflections, but I saw that in the reality of political influence mm-hmm. and being at the forefront of the economy.
And seeing that in the lives of these families as they extend forward, too.
Yes. And, you know, Monticello is the most moving example of this. But, you know, by the time Jefferson dies, he's so deeply in debt, he's tried every scheme he possibly can, including a lottery to save his estate, and that won't work. And his daughter, Martha, his at that point only acknowledged heir, mm-hmm. Is basically rendered homeless. I mean, she has, you know, well-financed children who she goes and lives with, but, you know, that part of his estate is lost to the creditors, and he's hardly alone.
Yeah, no, he's not. My guest today has been Lori Glover, author of Founders as Fathers, The Private Lives and Politics of the American Revolutionaries. Lori, thanks so much for this conversation. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun. Thank you for your excellent question.
Well, you're very welcome. For more historical thinking, go to historicallythinking.org, where you can comment on today's program and find show notes, links, and readings related to today's conversation. Historically Thinking is recorded in the studio of WAUG, the student radio station of Augustana College. Our program's editor is John Ruddat. Beth Leimbach keeps the schedules in sync. Matt Lejas keeps WAUG studio running. I'm your host, Al Zambone. Talk to you next week.